Hello and welcome back to another edition of Editing Aloud. And I understand to my horror that while I was away, we failed to hold in a budget edition of this program. So we're going to briefly go over the budget during the course of this one, which is why Hilary Joffe's next to me over here. But we've got a different panel today and some really, really good stories to talk about. But Hilary, just very quickly, Tito Mboweni delivers a budget that was obviously a long-term budget policy statement. Is that right? Medium-term budget policy statement. That was clearly prepared in advance, right? Did he do okay?
He did amazingly well, given how bad the numbers were. The numbers were a bit of a trench match, really. The debt got the deficit got worse. The debt got worse. Big revenue shortfalls. But I think the narrative that Tito put to it and his power of personality, if you like, will probably carry us through for now and hold off the rating agencies. And it was a fairly strong message of, number one, growth and investment, and number two, private sector, you're welcome.
Yeah. From him as well as
from Tito,
Cyril later on in the investment conference, which followed the budget.
Yeah.
I mean, to what extent, Juanita, do you think Tito adds politically to the strength of Ramaphosa's presidency?
I think it's just sort of the personality that he comes with, more importantly. And I think what I really looked at was his statements to the media before and after delivering the speech. And, you know, the sentiments around, service delivery and his kind of sentiment that, you know, why should the state just, you know, be delivering
services.
And for me, that was kind of a fascinating thing because it kind of went off script a little bit. And it kind of...
He's had a lot of time to think off script, hasn't he?
Absolutely. But
Twitter has twisted his mind.
But I do think that, the president is trying to sort of creative ways to reignite the economy. And so to have someone who kind of has nothing to lose politically, and he sort of portrayed that when he was talking in Parliament and later to the media.
Yeah.
And it was very blunt. I mean, this is vintage Mboweni, really, it was.
Yeah.
On the subject of public sector pay, and he said going into the budget, it's ridiculous how much we're spending on public sector pay. And he'd already put the unions backed up, but he was very, very blunt about the need to curb that and to stick with, you know, the path of right, both fiscally and in monetary terms. He also said, hands off the Reserve Bank. They're doing an excellent job. Yeah. Leave them alone to fight inflation.
Isn't that interesting? Because for the moment anyway, he'll silence a sort of raft of critics on a range of issues. Ron, I mean, does he ever become, the top of my head, I mean, but does he ever become a serious contender for Cyril's job?
No, don't think
you
so.
You reckon?
No, I don't think he has the... Yeah, he would be very entertaining.
Wow.
But I don't see him as such, right? That's a very good question. Tito Mboweni run for president.
President
no.
Mboweni.
No, I don't see him being able to go and build consensus with him and dealing with KZN
but he's
and so
a powerful
on,
guy. I mean, I don't know whether you follow central banking, Warren, but I mean, I was told that when he became Reserve Bank governor, they would go and central bankers would all meet in Switzerland. It was the Bank of International Settlement or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that the top seven would go off and have a private dinner of their own on one of the nights.
Yeah.
And he was very irritated by this. So he invited everybody else to their own dinner.
Mm.
And now that dinner has become the one that everybody wants to go to rather than the small dolly jowl and polite meeting of the seven. He obviously has injected Ron something into this administration.
Yeah, I think if given where we are and given the austere nature that the Treasury must speak, he's the perfect guy to speak it without fear, as Quinnington was saying.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of he does have some authority within the NEC, unlike Nene.
Is he an NEC?
Yeah, NEC.
Okay.
Member. When Nene was outsider, and Nene was just seen as basically like a technocrat in the true sense.
This is the force to be reckoned with.
Where Mboweni will sit there and argue with everyone and freely argue, right? And I think he backs himself up on that level. There was talks that he's an economist. Right? He'll even argue with Ramaphosa. Ramaphosa has some view on the economy which he doesn't agree with.
Yeah.
He's a character who'll say no.
Ramaphosa was brought up in classic sort of old boy elite capitalism, and Tito is a development economist.
Yeah, exactly. So I think he's a perfect person, bulwark in that for now.
Yeah.
I don't think long term whether he'll be finance minister after after the elections next year. I'm not quite sure he'll still be
really?
There. But yeah, something tells me that he's a stopgap, just to plug the gap. But yeah, that's from within the ANC.
I think we'd all miss him quite a lot. Warren, you were saying earlier on that the BBS Bank has come under more pressure now, so the Reserve Bank itself is saying, sorry, we can't help you. We've got to shut this down.
Bit of a political hot potato, because there'd been some people inside the ruling party and obviously the EFF that had called for the bank to be revived.
Yeah.
And certainly...
Well, even Tito, I think, didn't he?
Mentioned it in his speech as well.
Hinted at something to that.
But I think Tito's a realist and obviously is a man who understands banking.
He wouldn't get in the way of the Reserve Bank.
The fundamental idea of a bank is trust, right? And certainly when we learnt about what was happening earlier this year, we got to the conclusion that maybe 75% of the assets of the bank had been stolen. Yeah. I actually think they might have stolen more money because of the ability to create fictitious money that allowed them to make some of those acquisitions. So Kuban Naidoo, who is the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank and head of the Prudential Authority, the new Prudential Authority that supervises banks, submitted papers yesterday saying that it's all but over for VBS and is going to have it liquidated.
Hopelessly insolvent was the term.
Hopelessly insolvent. Is there political ramification to this, Cornita?
Yeah, so there's two folds to it. You saw the Sunday Times over the weekend saying that the VBS obviously received money from
the ANC received money from
VBS. So the one conversation is what happens to the people who are directly implicated. And now there's the discussion about the ANC Integrity Committee again. The last time there was this discussion was around, you know, former President Jacob Zuma. Yeah. And basically how much of a muscle they can flex. And that's going to be the big discussion on this weekend when the ANC meets for that particular reason, among other things. And then the other issue is just, you know, they were pontificating and pointing the fingers at the EFF in Parliament and so forth, and now they're at the receiving end of that now because they have, benefited from this loot.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be interesting to see what they come up with. But I also kind of find it quite fascinating that they would say that, poor people's money was not stolen from this whole VBS.
Oh, because of the Nedbank.
Yeah. Well, the state stood behind the deposits up to 100,000 rand. So the state stepped in with a guarantee, but the poor people's money was stolen. I mean, the taxpayers basically, as you say, have to bail them out. Yeah.
But also these municipalities that were affected, those are poor people. Yeah. You know,
that's more than 100,000 rand. They're losing that money.
But the difference with VBS and for, say, like an African bank, when it collapsed, at least there was... You have people out there to go to like reclaim money from. So the business case for someone to rescue it and get those monies back and rebuild the bank. Here, there's VBS. Where do you go to reclaim all these monies? It's like literally you got to go to the courts.
It's just completely broken.
Yeah, it's completely broken. As I said, it was a banking heist. So it isn't. There's no business case in anyone coming to rescue VBS, for instance. Whereas African Bank, when
and
it collapsed,
there
was
and is there any place to hide for those people who are named as having received money from VBS Bank? I mean, presumably, if Floyd Chivambu's brother in the report got money, then this the person who wrote this report could prove that, right? Yeah. I mean, so it's all directly or indirectly.
Yeah, but it's all
so there'll be an accounting.
Yeah, rescuing this bank was dead from the minute those guys looted. I can't see any recovery from it.
Yeah.
And the only way to get back those monies is to go to the whole.
And it's interesting there, but this comes at a time when I think there are four new banks in the offing.
Discovery
Bank.
Patrice Motsepe.
And Discovery Bank, if I'm not mistaken, is being the new CEO is Barry Hoare,
right,
who was the former chief of IT at SARS, who was fired by Tom Moyane, who declares in Business Day today, "I'm not the devil incarnate," so, and replaces him with a person verging on—I can't even think of an English word that wouldn't get me into legal trouble—as head of IT at SARS, so somebody who literally cannot explain her job.
Yeah.
And so we lose this guy to Discovery.
Right.
He's going to run it back. Anyway, that's just another story. Barry Hoare also worked for Nedbank at one stage. I think he was the head of IT there at once. And that's where he went to SARS.
Yeah.
So and then Michael Jordan, ex-FNB, he started a bank?
He's starting a bank called Bank Zero, which is a mutual bank as well. Also very reliant on technology to drive down fees.
Yeah.
So he said to us yesterday, it's in the newspaper today, that the cost of running The IT operation for Bank Zero is 1% of 1% of what it used to cost to run the IT system at FNB. That's and part of that he attributed to open source architecture and software, which you can access for free.
So, well, I mean, I don't give him any advertising, but I'm going to just briefly. I use his data thing, RAIN. And it's unbelievably cheap. I mean, and I use a lot of data, and I pay almost nothing for it. It's ridiculous. And then there's a third one. Patrice Motsepe is starting a bank.
Right, which is also very focused on tech and also going to be attacking banking fees as well. That's going to be called Time Bank, as we understand.
This has got an Australian connection.
Yes, originally developed by the Commonwealth Bank of Australia here. And then they decided, they did a portfolio and decision and decided they wanted to get out. So Patrice Motsepe's African Rainbow Capital will own that entire bank. And it's just awaiting signature from the finance minister. So that will also get going next year.
And people talk about the Post Bank. But if you speak to Mark Barnes, I'm not sure. Mark Barnes is now writing stories for Ron Darby, columns for Ron Darby, saying he wants one big state bank. And I think the Post Office would be
the central player in this. Yeah.
We should put him together with Tito Mboweni. I mean, they'd get on like
a house. Mboweni does want a state bank. Yeah. I know what he thinks.
Well, Barnes knows how to do it.
Absolutely.
Hillary, are these banks going to trouble Standard Bank and Nedbank and, you know, you're a banking writer
of old. Yes, look, I suppose.
I mean, if you were, you know, Mike Brown at Nedbank, would you be worried about Michael Jordan at
Should almost be welcoming it, because you need disruptive innovation to kind of keep everybody on their toes. And it has to be a good thing to get competition into what's been a banking sector which has been dominated by a few big players, though with the entry of Capitec, which has been a huge success. Yeah. I think there's long been, you know, thinking that we need more small, agile players in the banking sector, and particularly now. But going back to VBS, I think one of the issues for the Reserve Bank is to look at the lessons of VBS and how they managed to miss that, even though it was a very tiny mutual bank.
Yeah.
And to make sure that you can bring competitors into the market, smaller competitors, but also keep them.
But you will remember very well when we were both on business days.
And they brought a whole lot of small banks into this market.
A whole lot of small banks
and it all went
crashed,
horrendously
and it
wrong.
Went really badly wrong.
So I hope this time
and
we can get the competition.
You stopped me sending a photographer to take a picture. They all met somewhere, and I wanted to get a photographer to see all these bankers with their, you know, covering their faces with the newspaper as they scurried in to admit defeat, and Hillary stopped me.
But I think that was the last time, late 90s, when we brought lots of new banks into the sector, and it went horribly wrong. I don't think it has to this time, so we're really looking forward to competition, which is also well-regulated.
And certainly, I mean, Peter, the entry of Bank Zero, they're not even going to do lending. So they're just going to focus on transactional income and savings deposits, and then he's going to take the float and invest that into more wholesale markets where there's an interest differential. I would expect Time Bank would be equally conservative. Yeah. So in the past, I'd say a small competitor in a big pool, they might be at a disadvantage. Yeah. But when you start talking tech with some of these bank CEOs and you've got a guy like Michael Jordan that can build a bank from scratch without having to marry 100 different legacy systems like he had to do at F&B, they might be at a distinct advantage going into competing at a very primary level.
For Sim Chabalala, there's something for you to watch, as well as watch the rest of the program. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back. Juanita, you've written the lead in the Sowetan today. Anti-Cyril plot thickens. I don't know whether anybody can see that. It's basically built around the fact that former Northwest Premier Supra Mahumapelo is now joining a legal effort, to challenge the ANC National Executive Committee's decision to disband the provincial executive in Northwest, is that right? And as part of removing him. In that he joins a sort of a fight back in a way, I suppose, against Cyril Ramaphosa, started and made absolutely blunt by the pictures in the Sunday Times of the meeting at the at the hotel in Durban, whose name I momentarily... And you know, let's not be surprised. Guess who's going to represent them? Advocate Dalia Mpofu, the chairman of the Economic Freedom Fighters. Of course, he would argue that he's just doing his job and this has nothing to do with the EFF at all. But there's something else to play here.
If you want to fight the ANC as an ANC member, Dalia Mpofu is your guy. That's the trend that we've been seeing. But why the story is quite fascinating is... In the past, there's always been some legal action to big decisions made by the ANC and EC about disbanding leadership structures. We've seen it in the ANC in KZN, we've seen it in Limpopo. And so that trend is normal. But now, for a former chairperson, a strongman of the ANC, one strongman of the ANC, a former premier, to then sit back, first, you know, kind of distance himself away from this to see how the, sort of the political river flows and then deciding that, no, he actually supports this case and then wants to make his own representations. Now, what's quite fascinating...
Who started the case? Was it other... Other Northwest members, right?
So the ANC in the NEC in August took the decision that there was enough to warrant the decision to dissolve the leadership structure. Yeah. This was after they put the provincial government under administration, and there was a whole lot of infighting, etc., etc. Then this decision was taken, and then there was sort of a fight back, and you know, four ANC members. Decided to take the ANC to court. Now, that decision to take the ANC to court was taken the day after the great Maharani meeting, where Supra Mahumapela was present, Ace Makhashule was present.
Right.
And at the time, there was absolute you know, rejection of our story in that that matter was discussed in that meeting.
Yeah.
But now, this kind of the follow-up to that shows that there was, you know, a strategy that was in place that they were going to challenge this ANC decision.
Right.
And now they're challenging it on sort of technicalities. And the irony of this is that Supra Mahumapela, who was the former premier and ANC Northwest chairperson, in the past attacked ANC members for taking the ANC to court on decisions.
And using Dalia Mpofu.
And using Dalia Mpofu as well.
Yeah.
And now he's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the heads of argument, and the matter's going to be heard on Friday, you see
in
that...
In what court?
In the South Gauteng High Court, Johannesburg High Court. And so what they're trying to do is to force the court to reinstate him.
Yeah.
And the political sort of... You know, why this matters politically, rather, is because the ANC list processes are taking place.
Right.
Now, the list processes are extremely important, especially for a person who was once a strongman.
Yeah.
And so they would want to be in charge of the list process to ensure that they can have control over who the candidates are going to be for the provincial legislature and parliament.
Yeah.
And that really is, you could see the short-term measure to say, put us back in. We were going to be out in February.
Would there be a plan B if they fail in the court?
Yeah, so we kind of saw the plan B manifesting a little yesterday outside of Tully House, where there was that, you know, protest by some of their members.
Yeah.
And so it's almost, you know, a script. We've seen this.
Yeah.
Once you fail in court, you kind of mobilize popular support, and then you'll see kind of disruptions that follow. And I do think that this NEC meeting is going to be, you know, focusing a little bit on the list processes.
The NEC meet when? This weekend?
This weekend. It's a special meeting to discuss, you know.
Yeah, how do you get, actually, it's interesting. How do you get onto the list of, you know, because each party has a list of, you know, according to how many votes it gets, and your cutoff will be wherever your votes end.
Yeah.
So if you're number 99 and you don't get there, you fall off and you go back to your day job.
So the DA has an interesting process because they use like an electoral college type of system, and their system is a little different, where you apply for a job and then you get interviewed, etc.
Yeah.
But the ANC is that you would have to get branches to then submit your name. So they would... Each branch would have to submit, you know, 200 names. And then this gets consolidated on a regional level, and then consolidated on a provincial level. And then later in the year, it's supposed to be next month, but I don't know when it would be, there would be a national list conference where they then separate the list, national to national, province to national, and then the provincial legislatures as well. And then obviously the higher you are... the higher you are on the list, the more chance you are to become
an MP
minister or MEC. Yeah. So that's really where the power lies.
And does anybody have? I mean, is it completely transparent and democratic and open? Or
absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. I mean,
so how do you schlenter your candidate into the list?
So you know, before the NASDAQ conference, there was obviously these type of maneuvering about being on the NEC and being lobbied and. So someone told me this week that there's more at stake in the ANC list processes than the process leading up to their own internal conference. Yeah. And that's because, you guaranteed a job if you feature high up on the list.
Yeah.
And so there's that kind of maneuvering and lobbying. Yeah. But one other point, you'll see in that story in the Soweto, Peter, that they are arguing in court that if the NEC said that these branches were in disarray, therefore we have to disband.
Therefore the whole conference should be disbanded.
So then the national conference of NASDAQ. And so that's kind of like the point that I'm looking at to see how far they're going to push.
How can you push
in that regard?
Yeah. Good luck to them.
How much is it if the MPs, SG, what's his name? Ace is the main guy. So if the MPs are all kind of more Zuma friendly, And sort of goes into the ANC with the parliament, his MPs basically are a faction of Zuma. This whole push with the idea that they want to recall Ramaphosa earlier, is this also like part of a long-term game plan of eventually perhaps recalling him at some point?
Yeah, absolutely.
At some point, when it comes to MP.
And I remember the NEC is something that they don't have really, it's not strong either way, which is why, the Ramaphosa side would win on Northwest but lose on another issue, that kind of thing. Mm. So when it comes to the list processes, you want to push all your people into the parliaments, into the provincial legislatures. And in that way, if there's something controversial, your MPs block it.
Yeah, block it
and
off.
So eventually you have a lame duck president and a few of his little cronies that made it up the ladder.
Mm. Lovely politics. We've got it. We were going to talk about the investment conference, but as we're 1 week behind, Hillary, please come back next week. I want to talk about it. There's so much to do. But Warren Thompson has put his name, along with Amo Bongani, to the Financial Mail lead today. And it's a really good story about Marcus Huerta and Steinhoff, by the looks of it. And Warren, you've just run us through this, but basically you're saying that this investigation has confirmed what you long suspected. Former Steinhoff CEO Marcus Huerta held secret stakes in companies that traded with Steinhoff for years to his covert benefit. These deals' true beneficiaries were hidden from investors. What's been going on? What have you found out?
Well, certainly it's a very detailed description of how long it's been going on, how it was executed, and certainly I think what readers will find very interesting is that the Steinhoff family were beneficiaries of this, what we call self-dealing. So a grand tale.
Why would that be surprising? I mean, that's what crooks do, don't they? They steal. I mean, it's all for the family.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But certainly the fact that it was the family that had their name on the business that was also covertly enriching themselves through these.
The original Steinhoff family.
Right. Both.
So this is a crooked business right from the start.
It appears so, yes. It goes back 20 years almost to the time that they listed initially on the JSE in 1998. And you'll see a whole lot of funny structures and entities coming from places like the BVI, the Bahamas, that we could only really track because of the Panama Papers, as well as documents that we've been able to source from inside the offices of some of these people that were carrying out these deals. So this is in the
Steinhoff saga. This is new.
Certainly, the fact that the Steinhoffs themselves had been enriching themselves is new.
Yeah.
But certainly, we give credence to the fact that this was almost a criminal enterprise from the get go.
Hillary, just to bring the investor conference in here. I mean, exposing this sort of thing does us much more good than harm, I'm sure, in the eyes of the world.
Absolutely. I think foreigners are kind of struck by the robustness of our media now. Some of our survived, the institutions that have survived.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is one of that our institutions are sort of still strong, including the media and the courts and so on, is one of the things that keeps South Africa attractive, even though we have like practically zero growth.
Because it almost seems as if the tide is about to turn. You know, we're running. Tell me whether I'm going completely off the rails here, but you know, US employment is almost
it's
full now.
Yeah, it's basically.
Interest rates in the US are going to have to rise, right?
Yeah.
But ours are going to have to rise too. I mean, does it become a bubble when you've got full employment? I mean, when does all that lovely foreign
money
cash come back into emerging markets?
On my positive hat and say, look. As you say, U.S. employment is almost fully employed. There's talk of like a plateau in the U.S. growth. Yeah. They've reached at the top, and even when it comes to interest rates, this year might be the last year. And next year, talk of high interest rates is over in the U.S. And U.S. is due for an economic downturn. Now that is a positive in a sense for us, because once that the U.S. growth story falls off track, then money will look for other places to go. And if you look at in an emerging market pool of countries, I mean, you have Brazil that just a right winger is now the president. So in terms of that,
he's about to do something really stupid.
He's about to do something really stupid. So in terms of that, so next year, I think next year, if the U.S. story needs all the heat, must get out of the U.S. story, the FANGs, Facebooks, and so on, then money will look for other places to go. And if South Africa, given the strength of the Reserve Bank and it's in
the depth of the markets,
South Africa then stands to benefit from it going into next year. Yeah. But the U.S. economy must slow. Like it has to. Yeah. All the good news cheer around the U.S. economy must disappear. And I think it's due. It's due. That's almost 10 years.
And we've also be a nice opportunity next year to really squeeze the Brits when they come cap in hand for a trade deal.
Exactly.
And the things we want.
You know, I think the thing is that the kind of investment we're talking about is the sort of portfolio flows. Yeah. It's bond market, equity market investment.
But can't you grab that? I mean, I understand that,
but what we're looking for now is the FDI, the fixed investment, the more durable that will increase the capacity of the economy to grow in future. Because quite a scary number, which the Reserve Bank highlighted the other day at its Monetary Policy Forum, is that potential growth is now, in other words, the economy's ability to grow without hitting all sorts of it, is now, they reckon, no more than 2%, even if we got everything right.
Yeah.
So what we need is sort of investment that will open up the capacity of the economy again. And that means foreign and domestic direct investment, not just portfolio.
But it's great for confidence. We need like a confidence change in
confidence.
Like a proper confidence, like, okay, injection, something. Just like, let us breathe a bit. We haven't been breathing for the past, I don't know, 5 years, but since 2013, I would say. So just that. Okay, and amongst all our neighbors, I think South Africa is compared to Brazil and the rest.
I think the story is gradually coming right, but we'll see. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll see you again next week.